miss you when I
back, everyone. For today, I'm actually joined with Khalil, who has returned from the Doc Hayward episode. And before we dive into Dick Tremaine today, I'll hand over the mic so he can introduce himself further and tell us what he's been up to in recent months.
Hey, so I go by Khalil. You can find me on the wonderful and strange Twin Peaks Logcast, where with my co-host, the Unplugged Professor, we finished earlier this year 78 episodes covering the original series, The Return, the books, and the films of David Lynch. Lately, I've been mostly on YouTube operating under the channel name Snake Eye Dreams, where I've been doing a bunch of videos on a range of topics, including anime like Revolutionary Girl Utena, Sir Experiment Slain, and Cowboy Bebop, as well as some more American animation like Teen Titans and Steven Universe. A lot of what I'm into is character-driven analysis and thematic analysis, things of that nature. So I am very happy to be back on this podcast and very happy to be thinking about Twin Peaks again.
To dive right into Dick Tremaine, I know that he's in season two explicitly, but I think it's good to talk about where he's at in terms of before even the original series and Fire Walk With Me, because my question for when Dick Tremaine first showed up is that, what does Lucy see in him? Because later on, she does explain to, I believe it's Del Cooper, that he dresses well and exercises when admittedly Andy does not do either. But I still have to ask myself, what could have prompted her to meet him at Horn's department store and actually get to a point where they have a physical relationship? To me, it's just like, it just blows me away.
That's a really interesting question. I tend to think that, and maybe this is my misjudging of Lucy, I tend to think this was just a poor decision on her part that led to maybe a series of sticking with this guy who she doesn't even seem particularly fond of by the time we meet him. Given his behavior recently, it's not surprising that she's seen what he's like. So it seems to be something that came about rather unexpectedly. She mentions to him that they had that, I hesitate to call it romantic, but very passionate night where they wound up in the public display the next morning or whatever. So like, clearly it was something that happened quickly, unexpectedly. He made all these promises and assurances to her that at least in that moment she believed in. And considering she was currently on that break from Andy, maybe those promises seemed more appealing. But it doesn't necessarily seem to me this was a decision made in her best judgment to go with him initially. And, you know, who hasn't had a partner that maybe they look back on and they're wondering why they ever gave this person a second glance? I feel like that's how Lucy feels about this Dick.
I think you're onto some, because I think of like her interactions with Andy throughout season one, because it starts off wholesome enough with the two of them, but they spend a lot of that season not really talking to each other and like her being evasive. And when we get to the season one finale, that's when Andy is, everyone's talking about his like amazing heroics when they're at the Canadian border. And it actually does impress Lucy when Andy goes in, you know, to really like seal the deal with Lucy, if you will. She announces that she's pregnant, and then he just walks out completely stone cold, thus prompting where we're at with Dick Tremaine in season two.
Yeah, it's really easy to look at Andy as like this perfect model character. He has so many virtues, especially when we see him in The Return later, receives so much like spiritual power almost through the firemen. But there are moments where Andy falters, and there are moments where Andy's cowardice isn't necessarily emotional weakness as part of his job all the time. It can also be his inability or reluctance to really face head on these difficult moments in relationships, like with Lucy. And I remember back on my podcast with the professor, there were moments where we looked at Andy and just kind of squinted at him like, I don't know if I'm buying that you're as good of a person as sometimes the show even sells. Not that he's like a villain or something like that at all, but just that he's got flaws, that he does have faults of his own. And seeing those and being understandably upset about those, it makes sense that Lucy would also look at someone else who might be an option, making all of these promises that Andy in no way could ever provide either. But maybe this guy could. Maybe there's a sense of stability and almost benefit from being with someone of this higher status that Dick Tremaine very much sells himself as. What gets to me then is, what did Dick Tremaine see in Lucy? Because Lucy's obviously not this high class, like really prominent figure of who's who in the town, or someone like, I would imagine him going after someone like Josie, who is very fashionable outside the town, maybe classy in some. We know she's a big spender for shopping, so maybe he would be drawn to her, but he's drawn to Lucy, who is very much small town, ordinary, everyday, the kind of thing that ostensibly he isn't or doesn't want to be. So all I can really think about that is two different thoughts. One, that he never really was that interested in her at all, and she was just available. And that's a pretty cynical read, but he saw her as someone that was looking for that attention, and he gave it. And he doesn't really have any interest in her at all. If I look at it more charitably, which is actually how I tend to look at Dick Tremaine here, I think that maybe subconsciously she was the thing that he maybe wanted on a level he wasn't aware of. That it's her authenticity that makes her appealing. The fact that she isn't putting on any airs or pretensions, which is the opposite of himself, that can be drawing in its own way. When he's with Lucy, he doesn't have to try to figure out what she really is after, or what she's maneuvering, because there's no posturing. Lucy is just Lucy.
One of the things I was thinking of as you were saying that is that I think that while he does have a prefer women of a higher status, I think he kind of just checks out like almost any woman that has even like the slightest interest in him, or vice versa, because I think of it like the Miss Twin Peaks contest, where he's very clearly checking out these women. And I could see that just kind of being a factor of like, you know, when they cross paths at presumably Ben Horn's department store. And that just being like a thing of like, you know, just like having like that physical relationship with each other, even if it's just like a one night stand only. To kind of like veer into, you know, further in the relationship with Dick and Lucy, is that when he does show up to the sheriff's station, it is like, you know, he doesn't know at the time, but she's going to mention on her break of the double R that, you know, that she's pregnant. But that's not before he makes like really bad impressions, because during this time, everyone at the sheriff's station, they're trying to figure out the RBT letters that were under like all the fingernails. Lucy's in charge of like going through all these different anagrams, for lack of a better term. Of course, Dick Tremaine, he gets a little, you know, very pompous, and he's, you know, I think he's trying to come off as very cultured, but also very disingenuous to Hawk and his heritage. So Hawk, he just says robot for Lucy to write down, and then that's it. So people are very put off by Dick Tremaine instantly, and actually by the audience, for the audience as well, for that matter.
And in terms of the music cues as well, you've got this swing kind of song that is more upbeat, but also a bit silly. So he's introduced as a comedy character. So even the distaste that it feels like the show and directors and everyone are trying to instill in the audience for this character, it isn't the distaste for like Renault or Ben Horn. Like, it's the distaste for a funny punching bag, which obviously sets him up for what he's going to be. But the type of bad that he is not necessarily very effective or outwardly malicious, which I would say is probably one of the more interesting things about Dick Tremaine when we were talking about doing this episode, is that he isn't necessarily the worst guy. I don't think he's a Black Lodge, you know, respondent, but I also don't see him as being like anywhere near a virtuous person either. He's in this odd territory where I remember like looking in to see if anyone had really had much in-depth online about this character to see what's been said. And, you know, I haven't gone through every book and every material offline as well, but even just taking cursory glances through places like Reddit, he's often ranked as among the least favorite Twin Peaks characters, largely because of his storylines in season two being generally very silly, very kind of cartoonishly silly in a way that rubs off on the character. He doesn't have much beyond those moments. And if you don't like those scenes that he has with little Nikki or Andy or Lucy, you've got very little else to dig into. But that being said, there is still a small but vocal like scene of fans and contingency that upvote any mentions of the guy on the Reddit, and they'll make jokes like he's the key, he's the dreamer. And some of these theories actually do seem to be serious when it comes to some things with the return. But in general, most of the time he's either hated or he's kind of a meme. And I think that's an interesting status for a character of Twin Peaks. I'm not sure if I can think of anyone that's quite that way, because there's characters like Andy who are largely comedic characters and can be like physical punching bags for like boards to fling him and hit him in his face. And he's got like a slapstick moment. But people like Andy. People don't ironically say he's the secret to everything. They'll say, seriously, he actually might be because he has those contacts with the firemen. For myself, I like Dick Tremayne since first viewing it. I think that he's funny. I think that Ian Buchanan, even among a cast of incredible character performers throughout the entire run of Twin Peaks, he still stands out as one of the best at chewing scenery. And that's saying something considering there are so many actors in Twin Peaks that can chew scenery. But this man's smile says a million words, and some of them are contradictory at the same time. And that's a magic in of itself. And even if the scenario itself isn't like funny on paper, because some of the plots, when I revisit them, I'm like, yeah, I can see why it's not as funny for everyone. The dialogue for Dick Tremayne usually is funny, in my opinion. The word choice that he gets is so funny, especially in his cadence and delivery, that little tiny moments that themselves might not be that great are elevated by him. So I can see a worse version of season two where we never got Dick Tremayne. Because the best thing about some of these plot lines where he's involved is him. I'm more often laughing at Dick Tremayne in the scenes he's in than I am Andy or Lucy or Little Nicky. It's Dick Tremayne who's stealing the show for me in those moments. And just to summarize, maybe a little bit ahead of the time here, but my overall thoughts on Dick Tremayne, when I was reading through different sources online, there was this TV obsessive article written by Cameron Crane. And the way that they put it was, quote, "The thing is that as much as he comes across as a phony, he also comes across as genuine. He's a genuine phony." And that's probably the best encapsulation I've been able to find. And I also agree with regarding this character that he is a genuine phony. And like so many Twin Peaks characters, he invites contradiction, but it's not necessarily like the deepest, most symbolic, serious contradictions like Dale Cooper having the good and bad. This is like the contradiction of someone who thinks he's something he very clearly isn't, and every single person knows it. Maybe even on some level, he knows it and is trying to mask for it. But the comedy generally stems for me from the over-the-top way that he tries to make up for these things. And again, maybe not the deepest character, but consistently fun to watch.
Honestly, I completely agree. For a character like Dick Tremayne, you need to have certain writers to make him the way he is. And of course, Ian Buchanan's performance to add to that, because he's not supposed to be a likable character, but there is something that's endearing with Ian Buchanan's presence. Because, like you said, there's that smile that says, like, all, a million words, some of which are contradictory. And you can totally see that in his performance. And I think that that's why, when I do rewatches, even the stuff that like is considered pretty bad to many fans, I actually think that Ian Buchanan really steals the show and actually makes genuine good comedy out of bad premises. But I guess to talk about his pomposity more further is that now we have to talk about the scene when him and Lucy are at the Double R, and he's talking about his very pedantic, very overt way of how he deals with his work at Horn's department store. And it's very clear Lucy is not interested, right? Pretty sure she drops her fork just to divert attention, and it barely does anything. And it's only when she says that she's pregnant that suddenly he stops talking. Yeah, this is one of those scenes that I do really like, because I think they have good comedic chemistry with each other. And also, once again, in addition to Ian Buchanan's performance, Kimmy Robertson sells it as well.
I think we learn a lot about Dick Tremayne in this scene. Obviously, he's a bad date and a bad boyfriend, but I do get the sense that, and this is not to in any way defend his actions, he has terrible communication and is not there when he needs to be for this person. And clearly doesn't even seem to care that Lucy is bored the entire time they're there. But it feels like a lot of it stems from insecurity and this feeling that he has to compensate, because all of this talk about the mnemonic system for memorizing people's orders, who cares? Like, it's obviously so boring. And I get the sense that the reason, or at least one of the reasons, that Dick Tremayne is so in love with himself is because, like, he needs that feeling that he's important, that what he is saying has to be interesting because that's the most interesting thing he's got. What does Dick Tremayne have to himself that we know about other than this job that he constantly tries to embellish as being the status symbol? So it feels like when he's left to have a conversation, he doesn't really have much else to do than being his own hype man. And again, this isn't to try to wave away the fact that he was really bad for Lucy, but I also don't get like purely malicious intent out of this. I don't get any sort of like willful negligence, more so that he just is in his own little world and is almost sheltered from things and doesn't really realize what's going on until he's hit with something real and he has to confront something and has no idea what to do with it whatsoever.
They don't really show him returning to the sheriff's station. I imagine they just part ways after. But the next thing I do have written down is he actually compounds the problem when there's the rain / lightning storm at the sheriff's station. I forget if it's like later that day or it's like a day later, but he shows up and he's like apologetic to Lucy for how he presented himself. But then like it subverts everyone when he clearly has money. He doesn't say abortion, but it's very clearly what he's alluding to when he refers to the baby as a problem. And Lucy is very, very unhappy about this, to the point where she says that if he presses it further, she's going to scream. And she actually is about to, but then that actually prompts him to storm off. Do you have any particular thoughts on this scene and like the relationship that's going on with Lucy and Dick?
Yeah, I have a few things. So specifically on the scene you just mentioned, I think it's interesting when he says he could scrape together all the money he has, all he could scrape together was that $640. And I think there's multiple ways to take it, but I do tend to take him at face value that this man does not have a lot of money saved up. I don't take it that he actually has a lot of resources. So while I think his assumption that it's a problem that he needs to solve doesn't give Lucy agency and he doesn't seem that interested in actually hearing what she wants to do in the situation that clearly involves her, it does seem like in his own way, he's trying to put together his resources to do something that he thinks is his responsibility. And he isn't just trying to leave her completely in the cold. So again, with that sense of a little bit sympathetic and the sense that he is trying to do something, and I don't think he has a lot of money. I think we get enough evidence that he's actually not affluent as he might want to seem. So for him to even be able to scrape together the money, he cares about having money. He is giving that to her. But then also interesting too, is that before all this stuff happens, when he's saying how he hadn't, when she's talking about how he hadn't called her back, his reason for like why he hadn't called her back is how busy he's been. He hardly had time to feed his cat. And I'm kind of on two different tones where it's like the sympathetic side wants to say maybe he is working all these hours. Maybe he's got all these huge bills to pay. Maybe he's super busy. But also the best reason you could come up with is that I've been busy. I have to feed my cat. So it's hard for me to also like really be on board with that at all. Much as I love to be sympathetic to the guy, it does not read well at all either.
You actually bring up a good point about the financial situation for him, because I was always under the impression that he made pretty good money at Horn's department store. But the caveat is that he blows entire paychecks on his wardrobe, because you never see him in anything less than this like very expensive, very flamboyant getup. And I was kind of figured that was like, you know, if we want to read into it, that's just more of like he's focused on himself rather than anyone else. And I, you know, we could say that, you know, the money he scraped together, that's legitimately all he has, because I know people who used to work at a mall. Admittedly, it's mostly like when I was in high school or college, admittedly, but I know people that would blow $300 paychecks on just clothes. So I don't think it's too far off the mark that for someone like him, like you said, that who's very insecure, very much wants to prove himself to the world, that like how he dresses is like, you know, emblematic of what he wants to present himself as.
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to what exactly you think is going on with his job, because the way he talks about it seems unreliable and not always consistent, that simultaneously he has this elevated status as like the premier fashion source in the town while also barely having any money and he's overworked. So it doesn't seem to fully gel together. Because he calls it designer menswear, but I'm hesitant to believe that it's anywhere near that level. And so it seems like something he's prompting up, either because he genuinely convinces himself that it is, or he wants to play that trick for other people to think it is. But because Ben Horn is a well-known figure and people generally know Horn's department store, I don't think he's fooling anyone that he's not really that prestigious at all. So I tend to think that he is genuinely low on money, but I also think the take that he's spending it in the wrong places, and that's partly why he's lower on money, I think that's entirely valid. As far as evidence, we know that he wants to go Dutch with Lucy on dates. I don't think that's necessarily evil act, but considering he's trying to pretend that he has all this money, it's very jarring when he's like, bragging about this position, but also will not spend more than he has to. There's a disconnect there. And then there's that memory that Lucy has where he had promised to take them or take her to dinner at the Space Needle in Seattle. And instead he takes her to family night at the Pancake Plantation, which, you know, either he's cheap with his dates or he really can't afford what he promised. Either way, maybe a little bit of both. And his big way of making it up to Lucy for not communicating with her and not being reliable is to get her a new dress very pointedly at his 20% employee discount, that he will go to the local department store and he will get her a 20% off dress. And he can think that that'll make up for everything, which either speaks to how little he values her emotions or how much he values Horn's department store clothing. And maybe, again, a little bit of both.
Actually, the 20% discount is also kind of an interesting thing to mention, because I thought you meant it as like almost a compliment of sorts, where it's like, hey, I have this thing, I'll get you something very nice because I get this discount. And believe it or not, I've met people who are like that as well. And even for that matter, just like in terms of his work, because I met people, because I guess one thing that's worth mentioning is that what his job would be at Horn's department store, because I've seen people in previous jobs where they pretend to be managers. Sometimes it actually works for them, sometimes it doesn't. So maybe he's just a guy who works like minimum wage and he just like makes it look like it's more than it really is. Again, it's very much like opposite spectrums on like, you know, where he could be, but it's just that he's a guy who's like very like disingenuous. So you never get a firm read on 100% his situation. There's something about like how he presents the 20% discount that is not a good look for him.
Well, and the card art, if you take it to, you know, be canon or meaningful here, it says, because he's writing it from his own perspective, quote, "As the head buyer of men's fashions at Horn's department store, I bring the latest European vogue to an otherwise drab and dull Northwest fashion scene." So I'm not too familiar if someone's in the mid-90s referring to themselves as the head buyer of men's fashions. That just sounds like he shops there a lot to me. I don't know if that's actually the real title of the position or what it is, but he said he's the head buyer. And then when he says he's bringing European vogue, I'm just not convinced. I don't really see any evidence of that. When he's in charge of the Stop Ghostwood fashion show, all he really scrapes together is a ridiculous amount of plaid on top of plaid on top of plaid. And I don't know how impressive that would be to the European fashion people out there.
I guess we're jumping a little ahead, but I'll mention it since it was brought up. When I think of that Stop Ghostwood model show, I actually thought that like he got this top of the line stuff and all the people could kind of pick their own fashion. It's just that when Andy and Lucy come out, more so Andy in this case, where they just picked like the worst, like almost mismatch. But yeah, you can tell that Dick Tremaine is not happy. Like, you know, he's not really happy with Lucy and Andy generally through this way. But by that point, he was definitely just perturbed by Andy.
Yeah, I've read some different takes, like when I was going through Reddit, on exactly what you're describing, because some viewers have noted that he seemed a bit surprised or like mad seeing Andy walk out covered in like battle armor of plaid, whereas others have read it that that was all part of the plan. And I think maybe that's a bit unclear, just like everything else we're describing with his job. Who is this guy? Which I at least want to ask right now, you know, do you think he spent his whole life in Twin Peaks or not? Because according to the card art, again, he claims to have gone to Eton College in England, which in parentheses he notes is the best, of course. Has he been to England? Like, is he just lying at this point?
I think in terms of attending anything in England, I would say that's like probably a lie. I would say maybe he was like, if I had to guess, maybe he was somewhere other than Twin Peaks before the events of season two, but he just wants to make himself look good in this small town. Like he wants to always look like he's like ahead above the rest in a lot of cases. Almost like it sounds really silly, but I think in his eyes, almost like a beacon that people can look to for like fashion in particular and like be like a big part of their lives in that way.
I'm just wondering if he ever actually has been outside of this area or not, because he acts as though he certainly has, and he claims in the cards that he has, but it's unclear if he's just as much a resident of this town all of his life the same way that most other people we see in here are. But his response to living here is just so different. One of the things that popped up is that there's an interview where Ian Buchanan has mentioned that when he was first initially like explained what Dick Tremaine's character was going to be when Dick Tremaine was described to him, he remembers it. So again, an interview with the actor based on what they remember, put a lot of air quotes around this, but he was hearing it described as probably Dick Tremaine barely made it across the border from Canada. So like someone who is like an outsider who just like slipped in one day is almost how it sounds, or like scraped by. So the other piece of evidence, which is a bit contradicting to that idea, is that in the access guide, one of the players on the 1968 Twin Peaks high school football team is a David Tremaine. What do you do with that? I mean, 1968, it could be like a brother or something, maybe, possibly. But how common of a last name is Tremaine in Twin Peaks? I don't know. Like, is that intentional or not? What do you do with the access guide there? So I think there's that slippery element of, is he native to Twin Peaks? Was he born here? Does he live here? Has he ever left this place? What is he?
If I had to guess, he probably grew up in Twin Peaks pretty much all of his life. But he probably went on like a vacation somewhere where it's like this. It wasn't even like a great place. It was just a place that had this more flamboyant men's fashion, like maybe across the border even. And then it just became his identity. And like, thus like why he thinks he's like so alluring, thus, but also just having a reverse effect on everyone around him. But I guess also to move on is that when we get to episode 9 of season 2, we've had like a few back and forths with Dick, Lucy, and Andy about the baby. And this is where Lucy, she gives her ultimatum, more or less. They have to work to decide who's going to be the father. Before we get anything further in the scene, did you think for a single moment from that point onward that she would ever pick Dick under any circumstances?
In the town of Twin Peaks, anything can happen. But I think beyond the most extreme anythings, no, not likely at all. It feels very telegraphed that unless something goes catastrophically wrong, Andy was always going to be the one with Lucy in the end, regardless of the biological father of the child. But that being said, again, this is Twin Peaks. Season 2 finale did such a number on Ed and Norma that we know that true love can go awry sometimes here. There is a possibility in a world in which she would have remained with Dick Tremaine, either because something happened to Andy, Dick Tremaine proved himself, Lucy made a bad judgment, who knows? I can't see it being a best case scenario. Like, if this were a video game, I would assume that ending up with Dick Tremaine is the bad ending. You know, I would just assume that that's not the right result. And not just, again, because I don't think he'd be the best father we'll see with little Nikki. And also, I don't think he's right for Lucy. But I also don't think it's even what Dick Tremaine consistently wants. He'll feign at times that he wants to be this father figure. But when he's confronted with anything close to that responsibility, it goes so comically bad and just so absurdly in the wrong direction that it seems like he learns by the end that he really doesn't actually want this anyway. He's very quick to leave Lucy and the whole situation behind, give his good graces to Andrew, and move on to other pastures.
The only thing he does is a quote-unquote promise to improve himself. He's like, oh, I gave up smoking, like at some point before that episode. But even then, it's very clear that he doesn't, because we have to talk about this scene, because I know a lot of people, and definitely myself included, read into it. Because he pulls out his cigarette and he says to Andy and or Lucy, got a light. Now, of course, you know, with the return like in our minds, do you think that there's any connection to part 8 with Dick Tremaine saying this? Or do you think that a lot of people are just trying to read into what was a otherwise innocuous catchphrase?
Oh, boy. So I'm going to watch my words a little carefully here. I do not think there is any intentional meaning behind that. I don't think it was a callback. I don't think it's retroactively David Lynch or Mark Frost or anyone involved in the production of the show purposefully trying to imply that Dick Tremaine is a woodsman or trying to do any sort of thing that would add depth to Dick Tremaine's character. At best, maybe someone involved, David Lynch or otherwise, remembered that the line was said and wanted to do a funny parallel, because less about Dick Tremaine and more about what happens after the God of Light. So the fact that God of Light is said right before the smoke rises and that has an effect on the Bob Leland situation, I would think that the God of Light reference, if it's intentional, would have to do with Bob and Leland. not with the guy who said it. Dick Tremaine is just the guy who said it. He's the DoorDasher of the comment. Like, I don't think that it's about him. That being said, it is very funny to think it is. And if someone wants to headcanon that Dick Tremaine is a woodsman we see in The Return, that's very funny to me, and I like the idea. I just don't believe it was ever the intent. Now, intent, I don't think, is everything. And as I always like to remind myself, even there's multiple people involved, maybe someone on the team thought that that was the purpose and intent behind it. For myself, I don't take that to be a headcanon of it. I don't think that's what's going on, but I did see this theory pop up a lot when I was looking through the subreddits too, that he says it in a lowered voice, that he has a photo of a lumberjack or woodsman behind him when he says it, which I'm also thinking it's the Great North, not the Great Northern, this is the police department, but all these places have photographs of the woods and people in the woods. Like, is it that weird that there would be a photo of someone in the woods at the police department? No, it doesn't seem like it's placed there as some 25-year-long plant to be later used late. I'm just not so sure on that. But it is very fun to think in those terms. One of the more interesting theories kind of about Dick Tremaine in general that I remember running into, it was from someone on Reddit as well, where their username was I'm Not Me, I'm Not Me, very pointed here, said, quote, I have not really considered good old Dick Tremaine from the r/FindLaura subreddit, but the theory of Find Laura is that everything in Twin Peaks is the psyche of Laura Palmer dealing with the trauma suffered at the hands of her father. So they interpret, quote, the story of Lucy's pregnancy is the story of two fathers, one good and one bad, Andy and Dick. Played for laughs. The story of Laura's is of two fathers, one good and one bad, deadly serious. So if you want a headcanon, either Laura's the dreamer or Laura is the one in any capacity, you could try to say that even the joke stories like the Dick Tremaine story have a thematic tie into the big picture of Laura Palmer, that this in its own way, this whole identity of who's the father, what does that mean? That plays into the Laura Palmer story with her and Leland in its own way. I don't personally think that's intentional, and I don't always think of that when I'm watching a Dick Tremaine scene. I'm not thinking of the serious thematic weight, but I think it's a really fun way to recontextualize the scene, and watching the show through that lens, it makes sense.
I feel like I half agree and disagree, because I guess I'll start off by saying that I know John Bernardi and Blue Rose Task Force, he was immediately just like, no, there's no real connection. It was just like one line. But for me, I think of less of what it means to Dick Tremaine's character and more of how he affects the plot at large, because I think of like when he says got a light, I think of how important fire is throughout, like at least when Lynch uses it in Twin Peaks. I think of how that's the thing that sets Leland and Bob off downstairs. And I don't know what would have happened had a smoke alarm not gone off, like how long Bob and Leland would have been there, what the, Truman, Cooper, Ben Horn, everyone downstairs would have done. But the fact that Dick Tremaine's actions are what ultimately prompt Bob/Leland to, like, you know, burst through and ultimately Leland's death, I think there's something interesting about how fire is, like, such a big part in that scene and also the connotations of it in Part 8. So for me, it's definitely not as much about like if how much it's centralized around Dick Tremaine, but rather the thematic elements.
I would agree with that in the sense that I think Dick Tremaine is not the core component of this. Yet, if you do want to look at Dick Tremaine, it is interesting how intentionally or otherwise, you even could argue foreshadowing, where in his first appearance in episode 10, he enters with that happy jingle and he's in that outfit or whatever, talking to Hawk. But he looks at his reflection in the glass, grinning when he turns around, right next to the no smoking sign and the Have You Seen This Man Bob poster. And if that's our first impression of the guy, you could argue that's foreshadowing what is going to happen with the God of Light moment. Like, perfectly. I don't know if that's just kind of a happy accident, or maybe someone like David Lynch or another person on the set was looking back and like, hey, we can use this, because narratively they need a reason for what's going to happen with Leland in that cell. And if the idea of the fire and having the sprinklers go off was there, it makes sense maybe to do a callback in a clever way to the guy who was literally standing next to the no smoking sign, who has a reason to be at the department where Andy and Lucy are. So I don't know, you know, where the idea came from or how it came across. I just don't think personally it means he's a woodsman. You know, that's not the conclusion I draw.
Yeah, no, I would definitely not think Dick's a woodsman in any way, shape, or form. I think it's just like, because I guess for me, the reason why I'm like honing on the whole gotta light moment is that, I was mentioning fire, but there could have been anything that could have feasibly set off a smoke alarm, whether it was like a faulty smoke alarm, or maybe there was something that happened in the break room, or something like that. But I think there's just something interesting about how Dick Tremaine is like sets off what is, in my opinion, one of the most emotional scenes in all of season two, if not the original series for me. That, of course, being Leland's death and his we can always question like how Joan his confession is, but for Dale Cooper and everyone in that moment, that's a very heavy moment for all of them. So I just always thought there was like something like almost like a subtle humor of Dick Tremaine being the one to prompt that.
It's an interesting poetry for sure. And if you want to look at even the editing side of things and how it's scripted, that there's this talk about the blood test of who's the father, transitioning directly into them talking about the blood type situation. I think it's with like Jacques Renault or something. So like there's even that back to back. There's another moment too, when it comes to editing, although it's a very different scene, there's a part where they're talking about little Nicky and his parents were killed under mysterious, unknown circumstances. And in that episode, it cuts right from the mysterious death to Dougie Milford dead on his bed. So sometimes the joke is in the edit, right? It's just a very subtle, we're going to go from this to this, and they're totally jarring, but also complimentary. I think those are fun when they happen.
Actually, that's a pretty good segue because it's kind of utterly bizarre how Dick Tremaine is tangentially associated with one of these like gut-wrenching scenes from season two. And the next time we really see him is when the Devil Little Nicky starts to get off the ground. And actually, I gotta put this out there. I don't know if I mentioned this in the Andy episode, or I don't think I mentioned the Lucy episode, but I remember I had like a suppressed memory of Devil Little Nicky, like after I watched it. Someone brought him up on social media one day after I did my first rewatch. I'm like, wait, who's Devil Little Nicky? I have this moment, like, who am I thinking? I'm like, oh my God. Because I hated that arc for the first time. But I have to say is that because of Ian Buchanan's performance, it actually makes that arc a little more entertaining to me. Because I know that when I did my interview with Kimmy Robertson earlier this year, she was saying that she wasn't really happy with the direction that Twin Peaks was going at that point. She didn't say if Harry Goaz or Ian Buchanan felt the same way, but I'm thinking of like that was the arc that came to mind for me. But I have to say is that all three of them did a remarkable job in terms of delivering that storyline and actually like having good comedic beats when it did come down to it.
I would agree with you in the sense that, regardless of what you think of the material of the writing and scenario itself, I think the principal actors do a good job elevating it from whatever level you think that is. Even, the actor for Little Nicky does a pretty good job for child acting in a TV show from the 90s. It could be so much worse in terms of the acting from everyone involved. And I think that even if you're someone who doesn't necessarily love this story, it's not going to make your top 20 storylines of Twin Peaks. At the very least, there was some good work put into it. There was something good to say about those scenes. If nothing else, you get great lines from Dick Tremaine, like, let's talk about our bambino, and some adorable homeless waif. Of all the ways he could describe these things that he's talking about are very funny, endlessly entertaining. And I know you don't need me to tell you it's funny, that ruins the joke, but when it comes to Dick Tremaine, I just think that's always going to be part of it, is the way he says things is what makes it beyond just the situation itself.
Yeah, because for me, it's I have written down that I thought the car scene and then the scene at the Double R with Andy, Nikki, and Dick was a little bit absurd. But the part that really gets a kick out of me is that when Andy and Dick they go to Happy Helping Hand undercover to try to find out the mystery of Devil Little Nicky and like the death of his mother or the death of his parents, just to figure out what happened. But then there's this family come to adopt a child early on. They're like, oh, we're here for Donnie. Where is he? And then Dick is like, Donnie, he's dead. And then he realizes what he says and he sees like how their eyes probably bug up, dead tired. And then like they just kind of just walk off effectively after that. But I just love the dead tired part with Ian Buchanan. Like to me, it's proof that like even when an actor has not the best material, that like a performance can elevate it.
I just love the fact that that reveals the psyche of Dick Tremaine in a moment of pressure. The first thing he comes up with is that this child is dead. Like, that's the immediate, like, smooth, casual way to disarm the situation. And so, when we're talking about Ben Horn, because I know we're going to talk about Ben Horn at some point here, this is an example, I would say, of how he's such a he's so bad at what Ben Horn does so well. He cannot talk himself out of this paper bag. Like, he is struggling to maneuver any social situation with any awareness of what he's doing. I guess you could say the best he comes up with is he realizes he said a bad thing. And then he tries to compensate by saying, we're going to help these people. But the next scene we get of him, they've been found out and Doc Hayward's giving them a lecture. So clearly this didn't go over very smoothly. They got found out. What a surprise.
Although this is actually another scene that actually both credit to Ian Buchanan and Harry Goaz is that when they find out that, you know, Nikki's mother was sexually assaulted, she died in childbirth. Subsequently, his adopted parents died in a car accident. And they have that over-the-top crying. And all I can think is that I know that Lucy, she's very disappointed in Andy. It's probably the most disappointed she is in Andy during this whole ordeal. But I feel like when it comes to Dick, it's just like one more thing to throw in the pile for him.
Right. Yeah, it feels like there's a few things to dissect. I don't think it's maybe the best written scene in all of season two. But I do think that, depending on how you view it, it reveals some interesting things. We've already talked at length about Doc Hayward in our previous episode. I think the way he handles this whole thing is pretty interesting, how he becomes this father figure to these two adults, I think both of which he delivered. I know he delivered Dick Tremaine. He says that, I did not drop you on your head when I delivered you. So that would imply, again, he's born in Twin Peaks. But he has that parental role. But then even for Dick Tremaine, it's interesting that he cries too. It's not just Andy, who we know is emotional. For in the pilot, one of the first impressions we ever get out of Andy is that he is a cop who is crying at the scene of this crime. And he consistently is having to deal with those emotions. If Andy cries, that's to be expected of his character at this point. Dick Tremaine, we don't really see him have sincere tears very much. At least by this point, that's kind of an interesting twist. Now, it's done in the scope of a comedy scene, but it seems to have happened in reality of Twin Peaks. So I take it that it actually did emotionally affect him. He genuinely was moved by this and felt, I would think, guilty. There's this classic mix of comedy and darker elements that is so often in Twin Peaks that Dick Tremaine had blamed an orphan boy for the deaths of his parents, thought he was the literal devil, while himself masquerading as someone who wants to do good and be a caring father of this new child, just completely just the worst case scenario this could have gone. And we see these cracks in Dick Tremaine's facade at this point, and it's kind of both bad and good because he's not as considerate as he like feigns to be, but he also can be emotionally affected. So it's like the little Nicky in this whole scene brings out the best and worth in him. The worst part being that he can draw these extreme conclusions that make him look like a bigger fool than Andy, to be clear, because Dick Tremaine was the one who thought this was going on in the first place. He planted the little devil idea in Andy's head, and he's the one that came up with the idea of breaking into the everything. So, like, clearly this is Dick Tremaine's mistake first and foremost. He looks like he's just out of his element. But it also shows that maybe Dick Tremaine is a heart after all. Maybe this Grinch has a heart somewhere.
I think that reaffirms what we were saying earlier in this episode, where we were saying that how he's very pompous, he's very self-centered, but he's not malicious. He's not a Ben Horn. He's not a Leland Palmer type. I could only imagine, like, if it was only Andy crying, that would set for Dick.
And I don't know if you're going to have a Little Nicky episode at some point, but is Little Nicky the devil?
No, absolutely not. Unquestionably, no.
Because I would say the only evidence that would be at all compelling is that supposedly Big Ed had given his graces to Dick Tremaine about this vehicle, that it is working perfectly, and then it suddenly doesn't work. Now, it would seem that Little Nicky may have done something, either willfully toying with the tires, or maybe it's the dark luck of surrounding him. He can't even help it. Or Big Ed was wrong. Which conclusion do you draw?
I think it's like, while it is highly improbable that Ed would actually get that wrong, I think it's not impossible that something could go wrong, given that the car broke down, compounded with the fact that Nicky was just kind of toying with it. That just was a thing that like really planted a seed in Dick Tremaine, just thinking that there's something evil going on.
Yeah, that's fair. I never really knew how to read Little Nicky in that moment because he like looks back like he's waiting for something to happen almost, which if you want to read into the sort of mischievous side of him, we saw what he did to them in the diner. It's like, did you do any of this on purpose at all? But then when the car like moves, he seems genuinely really affected by seeing what could have happened to Dick. Like he goes to him and like hugs him, and I take that to be genuine. Like it's the clash again of what Dick Tremaine and Andy think Little Nicky is versus the reality that this is like a kid dealing with a lot of real trauma and hardship, and it's just this horrible clash of emotions. It's a very strange arc to watch because we can take meaningful things out of it about everyone involved, but at the end of the day, I think most of it's just a bit. Like most of it is just done for the comedy, I think, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I guess another reason why I never thought that there was like a demonic nature to Nicky is that I think of just like where we left off with the Leland Bob part, where it's like that explores like a true evil, like much more so in Fire Walk Me. But I think of just like how the evil was presented up until that point, and just the contrast with how it's like presented. Like I'm thinking of that scene when Andy, when he's thinking about what Dick said about that he's possessed by the devil, and it shows that little thought bubble in his head of like Nicky dressed up as a devil. I was like, oh boy, that's. I remember like the first time I watched that, I was just thinking of that contrast, and it was actually what soured that arc for me. And while it's definitely not like a top 10 arc, and probably not even a top 30 arc for me, if I'm gonna be honest, but at least like on subsequent rewatches, that everyone involved does make that arc like a much more entertaining ride because of their performances.
Oh, I love the devil Little Nicky outfit. It looks just like it was cobbled together at like a Spirit Halloween or something with this like flame green screen background. It's so funny. I don't know how it looked like when the show was airing on television on like a CRTV at the time, but like no matter how you watch it now, streaming or physical copies, it's just such a funny effect to me. I get such a kick out of it, regardless of whether or not it's quote unquote good or not. I'm laughing at it. The last thing I'll note about Little Nicky that I have in my notes is that it's interesting that Dick Tremaine's approach to Little Nicky and being this like big brother figure to him is to dress him up as a little version of himself. As noted in this Costuming Peaks article I was reading by Stephen Miller, there's this Ian Buchanan quote. Ian Buchanan said he loved the whole idea of the mini me. Quote, Dick in his ignorance deciding it would be very appealing to have a little brother dressed like him. So, again, quoting Buchanan's words of a mini me, it seems like his approach is just to make this child into himself, which I can read as either an extension of Dick Tremaine's ego that he wants to morph this child into a second version of himself. But I could also say, like, if he genuinely thinks he's dressing the best, he wants this kid to look good and he wants the best for Little Nicky. And I can't decide again which one I'm on between the two. Like, is it necessarily that it's a negative portrayal of him not knowing how to let Little Nicky be his own person? Or is it that he just wants what's best for him? And I feel like it ends up being somewhere in the midst of both, where in his ignorance of how to act, he just does what's natural for himself.
Honestly, that's actually a really good observation. But I would say that out of the two, I would still pick the first one because while you do make a good point that he wants if he's looking at this through the lens of a father-son relationship to a certain degree, that he could have easily just had him like dress like in some fashionable but something different, distinct. I think there's just the fact that's nearly identical. While it is actually really funny, like kind of seeing that alongside each other, I think it is a sign that there's still like at least a little bit of a self-centeredness and sort of imposing his views on little Nicky, because you don't see this with Lucy or Andy, where it's like they're not like insistent that they have to like that Nicky would have to look or act or dress in a certain manner. It's like definitely a very distinct Dick Tremaine thing.
As you mentioned that, it is kind of interesting to think that we never got much more with Andy and Little Nicky. Other than an initial diner scene, we just get the camping scene with Dick Tremaine, and then it's off to go find out what actually happened with his parents. I feel like there's a version of events where we got an extra scene with Little Nicky and Andy because it is imbalanced right now. I don't know what Andy is like with Little Nicky on their own. We never got that.
I guess the only thing I could really guess is that Doc Hayward was said this to Judy Swain, Molly Shannon's character of Happy Helping Hand, And it just kind of closed that off where it's like these two are just not ready to like really be looking after a kid right now. And then Lucy was just kind of go off in her own direction of like how to, I guess, kind of like grade them, for lack of a better term, of like how they would be fathers in different manners. But to ease into it, I don't really have much between Devil and Nikki and the Pine Weasel scene, but were there anything we should keep in mind before we dive into that?
I don't really have a lot of in-depth analysis on Dick and Andy's relationship. It starts off as this rivalry that then blossoms into something of a partnership. And I get the sense that if we had gotten more Twin Peaks in the 90s, season three would have happened. I assume that Andy and Dick would have had more scenes together. In fact, I would assume that Dick would have more scenes with Andy than probably anyone else. I associate that as the character moving forward, not so much Lucy. And it's interesting because they seem like an odd couple at first, where Andy is much more simple and straightforward and kind of humble in his approach, whereas Dick Tremaine is, with his diction and just general airs, has this sort of contrasting personality. But they're both so unaware of their situations that comedically they can fall into those same schemes, where Dick Tremaine is the, it's almost like a pinky and a brain situation, isn't it? Where like they're both just gonna keep failing. And I imagine that's what would have happened. But I don't know, unless you think that they learned their lesson after Little Nicky, maybe Andy learned and wouldn't fall for it again. But Dick Tremaine and his chemistry with Andy, I thought was pretty good by the end. And I do feel like maybe we would have seen more of it had it continued. That's kind of my feeling on it.
I feel the same way. I think that those two actually had a really good on-screen chemistry with each other. And again, there's only so much I could hypothesize about a 1991 season three, even with like the big players like Major Briggs and Dale Cooper. I mean, I guess we could talk a little bit about On the Air because that was initially going to be the thing that Ian Buchanan was going to move off to. I mean, even I think John Bernardi said on Blue Rose Task Force that they low-key wrote out Albert from Twin Peaks and that they were going to, he was going to go off to do his own thing. And of course, that would be because Miguel Ferrer would be on the air as well. Yeah, I think that's, so I guess it depended on like how On the Air went for the two of them and actually probably why they both came back, especially in Miguel Ferrer's case, so promptly.
Yeah, so full disclosure, I had never seen On the Air until we did this episode. I wanted to watch it just because there's only so much Dick Tremaine in the show. What is he like as Lester Guy? And I think it's a really interesting time capsule. If you haven't seen On the Air before and you're a diehard Twin Peaks fan, which I assume most people listening to this are diehard Twin Peaks fans, I would definitely recommend it if you're able to find it because it is such an interesting look at the sensibilities of David Lynch and Mark Frost, who were co-creating it, involved in the writing and the directing of it. And to see this explored in a very different style, it's got similarities to some of the goofier parts of season two, but takes it in this different direction that left me honestly a bit mixed on how I feel about it. I think the first episode and the last episode are probably the strongest, but there were some in the middle where I was like, yeah, I can really see why this wasn't a huge appeal. I can see why people would tune away because a lot of the comedy of On the Air is these over-the-top accents and silly cartoony sound effects. Like there's flatulence in the opening theme. That's the kind of highbrow entertainment we're getting here. And it plays like this big satire of the television industry, which by this time, obviously, David Lynch and Mark Frost had some opinions on based on what was going on. So it's really easy to read into that as maybe a bit revealing their ideas. My biggest takeaway from it, probably on a first impression, is it does show that David Lynch and Mark Frost, even if they may not have liked individual storylines of season two of Twin Peaks, they do like silly stuff. They do like some of the weird out there cartoony slapstick kind of comedy that is in season two. And the fact that Ian Buchanan was chosen as the lead of On the Air says that at the very least, David Lynch had faith in him as an actor and liked his work. So I don't know individually what did David Lynch think of the Little Nicky storyline in season two, but he obviously wasn't opposed to that type of silliness and having that actor in the forefront. As far as Lester Guy, again, I've only seen the show once, so maybe you'll have a bit more to say in terms of the comparisons, but they seem pretty similar between Lester Guy and Dick Tremaine. Lester Guy being this old Hollywood type that is washed up, whereas Dick Tremaine feels like someone that maybe never got his chance in the spotlight. But either way, both characters are trying to climb the way out of what they're currently in, and both just come across looking pathetic and looking like punching bags. It's also interesting to note that in On the Air, the person who's basically stealing his show from him, who he ends up hating and just wanting to destroy, is fairly similar to Lucy in ways that are kind of apparent if you watch On the Air. And obviously in Twin Peaks, he's not trying to destroy Lucy. If anything, you could read him as at one point being attracted to her, or at least drawn to her, and by the end ends on good terms in season two, ready to move on to the next thing. But he is destructively interested in ruining this woman on the show, on the Air. So that's interesting. And then you get the possibility of what would have happened if Dick Tremaine and Albert would have teamed up. That's basically what On the Air gives you as well. Because the character that Miguel Ferrer plays is basically just Albert again. And that was very fun to see their chemistry, where I get the sense that if we would have had Albert and Dick Tremaine have a storyline in Twin Peaks, it probably would have been something in my mind where they both agree on the criticisms of small town America, that anything Albert would dish out against Twin Peaks and the ignorance of the area, I'm sure that Dick Tremaine would agree with wholeheartedly and kind of pretend that he's like, oh, yes, I agree. But then I also think that Albert would, in like no pause, also cut down Dick Tremaine as someone who's thinking there's something they're clearly not. Like, I think Albert would absolutely have no interest or respect in Dick Tremaine, but Dick Tremaine might actually think Albert's right on everything else. So that, I don't know. I had a good time watching On the Air, and it was interesting to kind of get to it finally after being on my bucket list for so long. But the actual show itself was probably more interesting as a thing to study for me than a show I'm probably going to put on just when I have some off time. I don't think it's something that I would have enjoyed watching on the air, but I do think it's interesting as a footnote for sure.
Yeah, I guess for me, I know we were mentioned before we recorded, but the only episodes I like from On the Air were episodes 1, 5, and 7. It just seemed like there was something about the humor that it was kind of hitting a wall for me very early on, even though it did have very strong performances. You were mentioning the parallels of Lester Guy and Dick Tremaine, and I actually would say I agree with that as well, because they're very similar where there's that self-centeredness to them. It's just that with Lester Guy, in the show On the Air, he has a show called The Lester Guy Show. So when someone takes over, he's just constantly trying to sabotage her, and it's always working against him. Yeah, I don't think there's anything that would be malicious in that caliber for Dick Tremaine, but you can definitely see the fundamental aspects of Lester Guy and Dick Tremaine through Ian Buchanan's performance.
Yeah, it's almost like, what if Dick Tremaine had more power and prestige and weaponized it, but still failed about as much? That's basically what Lester Guy is. Just as equally unsuccessful in their endeavors, but on a more vindictive scale.
That probably wraps up everything for On the Air. Yeah, because the next thing we do have is the Pine Weasel scene. And the first thing I wrote is that I think the Pine Weasel scene is the last actively terrible scene in all of Twin Peaks, because I think by this point, most of the quote-unquote bad arcs are wrapped up. But I'll be honest, I've never really cared much for this scene. I thought it was a little too absurd, even the realm of what is going on here. But I guess before we get into like the Pine Weasel going loose, we can talk more about the fashion show, stuff we didn't really talk about beforehand. Tim Pinkle and his interaction with Dick Tremaine. There's like a lot of stuff that goes off like once this Pine Weasel runs loose.
I have a pretty charitable emotional response to the Pine Weasel story. Not story, but the way it's executed. Because, again, Ian Buchanan selling this and the way the dialogue's written, The idea of him saying, "Hello there, little pilgrim," before the creature that's described as non-aggressive then attacks him so brutally and gets this like first person point of view camera, like it's Jaws or something, I think is actually pretty funny. Obviously, that's super subjective. And not to dredge it back up, but with On the Air, I've seen people describe that this Pine Weasel scene's like the closest Twin Peaks gets to the tone of On the Air. Like, I could see the Pine Weasel scene happening on the Air, because that show is so often a Rube Goldberg machine of destruction where something goes horribly wrong on a set of a TV show, similar to how here it went horribly wrong on the set of the fashion show. So it reminds me a lot of that, for the benefits and the negatives of that. I think that it's an okay scene because, as silly and inconsequential as it is, I'm not having a bad time when I watch it. I find it kind of funny, if only because, again, of the little execution and flourishes on it, and how it's implied that the reason he attacks him is because of his cheap cologne. That, again, might be something you could argue about Dick Tremaine's actual finances, and maybe that's emblematic of Dick Tremaine himself that he's wearing this cheap cologne. You could draw some symbolic conclusions from that. But overall, I thought it was fine. I would say I maybe weigh the wine tasting scene a little higher. If nothing else, because of the way that he shouts at Andy as soon as Andy does anything wrong. It's visceral, and I feel bad for Andy, but I also kind of feel bad for Dick because if anything, this is the best time for him to show off his interests and his passions and feel like he's mattering, right? Dick Tremaine has probably been waiting for a day like this for months, and then he gets to do this event. He gets to lead a wine tasting event and show off in front of everyone. And immediately he's thwarted by Andy doing all the wrong things. I kind of feel bad for him, even if he's brutal to Andy at the same time.
I guess to ease into this scene, for me, the Pine Weasel scene, I think the reason why I'm a little bit critical on it is that I think that while the music, I mean, of course, it's Angelo Badalamenti, so of course the music's good. I think that it has such like a Benny Hill sort of feeling to it that I just couldn't quite overlook. But to contrast that with the wine tasting scene, I think that we're left with like something that's a little more restrained, where I love when Dick Tremaine says, spit it out with just like this visceral anger. And of course, Harry Goaz is also a great opposite of Ian Buchanan, so his comedic time is really good. Lana, who is not a fan favorite to put it lightly, I think the allure that she has on Dick Tremaine, like of course that's planned for something that would later on happen with Miss Twin Peaks, but it does show that Dick Tremaine definitely has a type. There's a type of woman that he's actively pursuing. I think even put aside Lana's pheromones, I guess you could say, that I think he would have been like head over heels for her no matter what. And I think the fact that she's so entranced and like invested with like the wine as well, it's just like another thing where he's connecting. And it's also showing that he's not a very good father because he's not being faithful with Lucy right there. So I think that's also something that's very telling of Dick and how he handles himself on a general way.
No, I would totally agree. And with regards to segue a little bit to comparisons with Ben Horn, I think that there are these little moments where we see echoes of a Ben Horn type in Dick Tremaine, even though they don't really have much, obviously, together. The most involvement they have is that Dick Tremaine is involved with these events for Stop Ghostwood. But otherwise, they're not like key players together. Ben has scenes with so many members of the cast, and Dick Tremaine is not even in the top 10 characters that speaks with him in terms of how frequently they're associated. But I can't help but agree with my podcast co-host, who I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember the exact way he phrased it, but that Dick Tremaine is something of a discount Ben Horn. Or the we already have Ben Horn at home kind of Ben Horn, where he will quote Shakespeare at Lana. He'll quote Shakespeare the same way Ben Horn quotes Shakespeare when he's over at the One-Eyed Jacks. And he'll put on this sort of air to manipulate and scheme and try to concoct all these different ideas. And obviously, affluence and status are important to him. And all these things give the idea of a Ben Horn. Like, if you're playing some kind of game and you had to describe Ben Horn to someone without saying any character names or something, and you describe someone who stands for affluence, sophistication, quotes Shakespeare, and has this sort of status in the town and feelings of status, that could describe Ben Horn, but it could also describe Dick Tremaine. The problem is that Dick Tremaine doesn't have any of the actual, like, stat points to back that up. He can't do any of the things that Ben Horn can, which is an interesting situation because I imagine if Dick Tremaine had the power and resources of someone like Ben Horn, he could do unspeakably bad things. He could be so malicious, but this might just be a case of he's rendered more sympathetic and not as bad simply because he doesn't have enough good luck to do it. Like, this is one of those guys, he got like a genie in a lamp situation. He'd be a Disney villain. But because he doesn't have any of that stuff and he lacks the tact to do it himself and he lacks the muscle of someone like a Hank Jennings or a Leo Johnson, he's just kind of a nuisance at best. Maybe he's a bad boyfriend, but he's harmless. Dick Tremaine is ultimately harmless. And I think that there's a world in which he isn't. I think there's a world in which he could be darker if he had those talents and resources. And that's kind of Ben Horn in a weird way. I don't know.
I think you're onto something, because I'm thinking of that scene after the Pine Weasel ordeal where, of course, this is when Dick, he has his nose covered because of the injury. And the first thing he says is that he's going to be in touch with his lawyer because of how the show went awry. And we get Ben Horn, who's like relatively newly reformed at that point. And he says something akin to, the desire to do evil sometimes almost outweighs the desire to do good. But then he pulls out the carrot in this comedic bit to kind of prove that, yes, he is just going to do the right thing. And so I think that the discount bargain bin Ben Horn is not that far off, because he's, strange enough, probably the only thing that kind of hinders Ben in any way, shape, or form. Like, even when, he confronts, everything with Audrey or the whole Donna situation being the father, there's all these other people he's interacting with, like Catherine Martell. Like, he even kind of forgives her for the Mr. Tojimura thing. But somehow it's Dick that's the one that really...
Sorry, as you were talking, the thought dawned on me that you could also draw that comparison too, that Ben Horn and Dick Tremaine both have plot arcs where it's dubious of who the father is, right? Like that's also a thing, which if you go back to the interpretation about Laura Palmer, you have another bad father, good father situation. That's weird. I don't know if that's intentional, but the fact that they do have that recurring plot element that both Dick Tremaine and Ben Horn have, it's lucky for Dick Tremaine that he didn't get his head bashed into a fireplace.
No, for a moment, I thought he said something that was completely contradictory. I was like, oh, wait, maybe I need to do a rewatch again soon. But that's a really good parallel.
I don't know if it means anything other than that Andy isn't going to throw anyone into a fireplace.
It might not, but I would say it's something that like bizarrely retroactively fits in, like with the themes of like approach the end of season two. But I guess to go on, because we were mentioning a little bit about with Lana and Dick's relationship with her, is that we have the Mayor Milford, we have Norma Jennings, and we have Dick Tremaine all on to be judges for Miss Twin Peaks. Wow, what a cast to have to interact with each other. I actually kind of wish that we had a little more with Dick Tremaine and Norma Jennings. I feel like those two would be like oil and water at any given moment. And of course, we have the mayor, who, of course, he's trying to do everything to rig this in favor of Lana. We get the scene where she seduces him, and it's kind of what he wants, but also very unexpected for him as well. Yeah, there's definitely some foul play going on with this, even beyond with Lana's pheromones. What I'm trying to get is that, what are your thoughts on Dick Tremaine and his role as a judge of Miss Twin Peaks? And also, how did he, of all people, get this role to begin with?
Well, that's a great question on that last one. We'll never know what the process is like, because the mayor makes sense, Norma makes sense, and there's just an odd one out. The pragmatic, kind of cynical side of me just thinks, from a writing standpoint, who in the town would want to do a fashion judging job? And it's like, well, you've got the guy who constantly is judging people's fashion. Like, from a writing standpoint, Dick Tremaine makes sense to be the guy. I don't know in universe if there's even a clear explanation. If Ben Horn is involved in some of the funding or some of the operating here, we do have a connection there, but I don't even know if Dick Tremaine is high up on Ben Horn's payroll enough to even be a blip on his radar as someone he's going to recommend for the job. It just feels like he might have been the first person to volunteer. Like, they were looking for a judge and Dick Tremaine wanted to do it, because frankly, not everyone in the town, as far as characters go, maybe would even want to do this and want to take time to be a judge. Whereas Dick Tremaine, let him have it. He's passionate about the topic. So part of me wonders if it's just something he was at the right place at the right time, wanted to do it, and why not? Let's have the guy do it. But he definitely doesn't seem the most qualified. We don't have any credentials to name, like having a government office or having previously won a pageant. Like, we don't have anything on that level. So I don't know right off the top of my head if someone would have been quote unquote more qualified, but I also don't know if there's a reason that would exclude him. He just works for it, I guess. And as far as the Lana storyline, I think it says a lot about Lana, but what speaks to me the most is obviously the subversion of the conclusion where it doesn't work. The fact that this guy, who we've been given almost exclusively negative traits on throughout his comedic appearances, that, you know, he wants to do these bad things but just isn't capable, and you give him the situation of obvious temptation, obvious benefit, and he goes with his heart. Like, he actually, again, to parallel Benjamin Horne, he might actually have a heart in there somewhere, and he's moved by the speech with Annie. So that's probably the thing that I find the most compelling, is that he actually doesn't give it to Lana at all.
Yeah, no, actually, sorry, there's a lot where I can kind of go with this, but I think the first thing I'll go with is that you mentioned earlier about when Devil Nikki, when they found out that he's not a devil in any way, shape, or form, that Dick is crying, which was kind of a thing that seemed like expected from Andy, but maybe less so from Dick. But maybe like that's like you could look at that or read it at least that, you know, there's that little bit of a heart in him. And that was like what truly appealed to him, that like what Annie said superseded anything that Lana did with him, like in that broom closet or anything that she did on stage. And I always thought it was like a bit far-fetched up until this recording even that he would pick Annie's speech. But with all the stuff we've been talking about, I think it actually makes a lot of sense.
There's a heart under there. Like, he's not a Black Lodge, Tulpa, doppelganger, pure darkness of the eyes kind of guy. He is someone who is insincere in some ways. He's someone who is insecure in certain ways. He's someone that tries to impose upon other people for his own gain, sometimes even unwillingly. He takes advantage of people's trust. He misunderstands situations drastically and can get people hurt, but he doesn't seem conscious of most of it. He doesn't seem like someone willingly trying to do these things, and not in the sense of like, did Leland know what he was doing when Bob was possessing him? But in the sense of someone who I don't even know really if he knows himself, he just seems kind of confused. And so a lot of these negative traits that are red flags in him don't come across again as malicious, even though when you look at like the some negative like carbon footprint of the guy in terms of his effect on other people, what's the worst thing he really does other than just be a jerk and be kind of, you know, incommunicative? I think we don't really see him do a lot of damage. Lucy's the person he hurt the most. And even then, I think Lucy's forgiven him. I think she's done with him. I think she wants to be away from him, but I don't get the sense that she feels like she's still owed by him at the end of the day. So I think he kind of gets something of a mini redemption at the end through this act. And again, hypothetical season three withstanding, we don't know what he would have been after it, but kind of the last impression we get of Dick Tremaine is that despite it all, he has a heart and he actually can be moved. And again, going back to that genuine phony idea, there is a side of him that despite all the contradictions seems earnest and seems to be what he says he is, even if he doesn't know what he is.
I will say, though, is that maybe one thing that might undercut the heart underneath is that this is the night when Lucy decides who the father is going to be. And you and me, we both were talking about like how we felt like who would be the father in the end. And while I thought it would unquestionably be Andy, I did actually think that Ian Buchanan's delivery of the best of luck and he just kind of storms off is like the most Dick Tremaine thing that could have possibly happened that night.
And that is true. 100% true. And yet at the end of the day, whether right or wrong, I'm less mad at him than I am amused by it. I find it more funny than like I'm shocked or offended for Lucy's sake. And even Lucy seems to just take it that way too, where she's like, geez, you could have had more of a response. But she doesn't seem like hurt by it at all. Dick Tremaine is just Dick Tremaine.
This is actually why I kind of think that it was going to be Andy all along, because it just kind of seemed like they're like, oh, well, it's like he wasn't going to be the right father, but was this really the way he was going to do it? But it was like done in like the best like comedic performance by Ian Buchanan. And admittedly, that and then Annie winning Miss Twin Peaks is pretty much the last we see of Dick, because that's, of course, when Wyndham Earl comes in to sabotage to take Annie. But I think that to ease into where he'd be at in the return, I have to ask you. I know Lucy didn't pick who was based off the biological father, but rather who'd be more fit. Who do you think Wally Brenner's father truly is?
Headcanon, I interpret it Dick Tremaine. Headcanon. Intentionality, I would assume they either didn't care or maybe it's meant to be Andy. I don't know if like they, David Lynch or Mark Frost or anyone really had it in mind, we're going to make Wally Brando be the actual secret son. I don't know if that was an intended aspect. And I will say that when I headcanon it being Dick Tremaine, I think that's just the funnier result. I think that's just the more amusing way it could have gone. But if we're talking, you know, anything serious here, which is hard to do with Wally Brando and Dick Tremaine of all characters, you know, I'm more on the the nurture over nature kind of side of things, where I believe that regardless of who the biological parent is, he is still the son of Andy. And that's obviously who raised him. And that's obviously what he's going to take from. I don't believe he's like got a genetic curse running through his veins of the Tremaine bloodline. And if anything, on that note, the Twin Peaks series and some of the books especially seem to indicate the idea that there are like family curses, that you've got people like the Horns who there's something hovering over them, or like the Hurleys, there's something hovering over them, or Martells, obviously. So if we even have any idea of what a Tremaine or Brennan curse would be, maybe we could try to detective work. But Wally's got one scene. And we don't even know the families of Dick and Andy. And I don't even think the books hardly go into their genealogies. So I think even that kind of reasoning, we just don't have enough information. It's like insufficient to even draw that kind of conclusion if you wanted to. I just think it's funnier if it's Dick Tremaine. So I'm on that side.
I would say that I don't think Winter Frost really had a really strong take or anything that they'd implicate in either the return or the books. But to me, I always thought it was like, that is definitely the son of Dick Tremaine, because I think there's just that, I know you keep using it, but I think it carries over with Wally Breno, but there's that just like pomposity with how he presents himself. Like maybe he's a little more softer spoken than Dick Tremaine. Maybe it's not like explicitly self-centered, but there's just something about like the fashion and just like this, I don't know if there's any other way to say it, but kind of up your own ass sort of type of personality. Because even like Frank Truman, like for example, like Frank Truman is like an absolute saint. Like this guy, he's doing everything, holding down a fort in a Twin Peaks that's totally different. He has a wife that where it's like, you know, things are not the best at home. You know, he has to stand outside to see Wally Brando. And once he finishes, you just have this blank look that I kind of determine it in my mind is like internal screaming from Frank Truman. Like he just wants to get back inside because it's too cold. For me, that's kind of where I stand with Wally Brando. But the reason why I bring this up is that I think of when Twin Peaks Unwrapped did their interview with Ian Buchanan. I don't know who he was talking to, whether it was Lynch or Frost or Sabrina Sutherland, but it was circulating around for a while that Dick Tremaine was going to show up in the return. And my take is that he would have been there for that scene, and that I don't think there would have been any explanation, but there would have been some sort of ambiguity alongside who the father was, whether it was talked about or not. But did you have any thoughts about Dick Tremaine's role in the return?
Well, it's another one of those things that it depends on how you interpret what little information we have. The 25 years later interview that I was looking at, he said that, quote, "I was gone while they were shooting it, and I kind of was part of the conversation, and it would have been very nice to do." He went on to say that he had talked to Joanna about it. So it seemed like he got further into the conversation than some others who did not return, but it's unclear how far in the process that was. And it doesn't really seem like he really knew why it didn't happen or what, you know, where it went. And so I would imagine that if there was the intention of bringing him back, whatever storyline it was pretty small. It might've been a one scene sort of endeavor, like how Wally Brando got one scene. And whatever it was, they just didn't think it really needed to be in there or fit the tone. And the return is paced so curiously where I simultaneously want to say that there's no extra room to add more because it's all perfectly the way David Lynch and everyone else wanted it to be. But then at the other hand, it's like there's so many scenes that go on for a long time or don't seem to fit the rest of it. And whether you love or hate that fact, it's a paced in a very strange way. You easily could see them cutting out something to put it if they really wanted to. But that goes for, you know, Josie. That goes for Catherine. That goes for Hank. That goes for any character you'd want to retroactively see where they'd go in. Now, what do I think would have happened with the character? There's a Q&A where Mark Frost indicated, however seriously you want to take it, that Dick Tremaine was a real estate salesman in Washington as of the 2010s. And quote, "He once tried to get in touch with Wally Brando. Wally ignored him," end quote. Do you take a off the cuff word of God from Mark Frost on Reddit as being serious? That's up to you. I don't think that's enough to call that canon in my head, but it is a fun thought. I mean, I know that same interview, Ian Buchanan had his own interpretation of what he think happened to the character. I think he was like a salesman of some kind. None of them really necessarily aspire that he's doing much more than some other form of selling things and not really being any higher up than he was before. I don't have like an arc in my mind. I think the weirdest thing to me to picture, in fact, would be imagining a storyline or scene involving Dick Tremaine that has no music because the return is so quiet. And I'm like, what is Dick Tremaine reading like with no sound, grinning like the Grinch in an awkward, like slow paced exchange? Like, I have no doubt it'd be comedy. I can't imagine his scene would have been serious, but I also am trying to imagine the way the comedy would have hit with no music and the understated kind of tone of the return, because comedy in the return is so different usually than comedy in season two. So I think it would be very strange. Maybe I'd want to see it for that reason alone.
I remember after I record my Shelley Johnson episode with Greg from Tweets Cafe, I think we were talking about it after we recorded, but we were actually on differing opinions on like if Dick would have actually been fitting in something like The Return because of a lot of the stuff that you mentioned, because there's something about that campiness that feels right at home in the original series that I didn't think would quite carry over. But actually, it was Greg who actually convinced me that the whole Wally Brando thing would have been like a factor. And as time went on, I just thought, yeah, that makes sense. And between what you said about Mark Frost and the AMA, yeah, I mean, I know that it's, I know the word canon isn't really the best word for it, but I would agree with you that using that AMA isn't probably not enough to substantiate it, but I figured that it was at least worth addressing.
I will say if Mark Frost felt that strongly about it, it probably would have been in one of his books, right? Like if he wanted to throw in an aside about Dick Tremaine, he could have found a way to do it in the final dossier, because he obviously found ways to talk about Lana, to talk about Norma's mom, like to talk about characters that are generally not at the forefront of everyone's imagination. They're in there. So I think Dick Tremaine could have been mentioned in the book and wasn't. And as a fan of Dick Tremaine, I don't think it was needed. I'm not feeling bitter or like, oh, what we could have had, because I think the most we would have gotten is like a paragraph in a book or a short scene in The Return. I don't think we would have had much more, nor did we necessarily need much more. I think just in this moment that you're asking me, I like to imagine a scene in The Return where it's unclear to the audience if the actor Ian Buchanan is playing Dick Tremaine or Lester Guy, and it's left ambiguous enough by the way he's acting in the lines that fans are all discussing on their little groups which one was it. And there's people who believe it was Lester Guy, people who believe it was Dick Tremaine, and it's unclear because there's so many scenes that take place in other locations outside the town. You could put him anywhere if you want. So, and then in the credits, just list him very ambiguously. List him as the well-dressed, no, the sharp-dressed man, actually. List him as the sharp-dressed man and do not elaborate who Ian Buchanan is playing. I think that'd be funny in of itself.
Honestly, that would actually have been a really clever one. And I think that pretty much wraps up everything on my end about Dick Tremaine. Did you have any final thoughts about him before we sign off?
Nothing mind-blowing. I just want to state, because it didn't come up anywhere else, one of my favorite things in the card art of all the cards is how in Dick Tremaine's card, when he is talking about his weaknesses, there's a strengths and weakness section. For strengths, he says, I am an impeccable dresser, superb dancer, a qualified clothier, and a smoker. Those are all strengths. Weaknesses, he says, quote, it is so hard to express negative thoughts about oneself. And I love that so much. I love that so much for him. Whoever wrote that card did a great job.
That is the most Dick Tremaine thing you could have possibly put out there. Yeah, I think that wraps up everything. I know you plugged a lot of your social media and where people could find you early on, but was there anything else you want to plug before we head off?
No, mainly just check me out on YouTube for Snake Eye Dreams, as well as where I have our podcast on there. You can also find the Wonderful and Strange Twin Peaks Logcast, wherever podcasts are found. We have a Twitter, Snake Eye Dreams 1. I don't use it very often, but you can find me there if you want updates on what I am doing these days. So once again, thank you for having me on. It was a pleasure talking about everyone's favorite Dick. Together.